The grimdark universe of Warhammer 40K is without a doubt a terrifying place to live. It is a realm where humanity is besieged on all sides by legions of enemies and horrors beyond imagining. However, its lore is often presented to us on a macro scale, one that is so incomprehensively large that it becomes difficult to truly imagine ourselves within its depicted events. As a consequence, many of 40K's more horrific, bone-chilling elements can often go unabsorbed and unprocessed by the reader. It is, however, when we begin to peel back the layers, when the scale shrinks down to a single individual, and not an elite superhuman warrior or a trained member of the militarum, but a single civilian with no combat training, that we finally have a relatable lens to ground ourselves with. It is then that the creeping dread and spine-tingling terror that festers just beneath 40K's surface is revealed in its full, terrible glory. The title of tonight's tale is Pentimento by Nick Keim, a short story included in the Warhammer horror anthology The Harrowed Paths, released in February 2021. As always, I implore you to support the original release and have included a link to this anthology down in the description below. Additionally, I want to give an extra big thank you to Louise of Rogue Hobbies and Chris Tester for lending their voices to this project. Both of their channels will be linked down in the description as well, and it would mean a lot to me if you went over there and supported them. Louise does amazing miniature painting work, and Chris is a professional full-time voice actor with a deep love of 40K. In tonight's story, we cross the Great Rift and venture into the dark corners of Imperium Nihilus, far removed from the Emperor's light. Here, we find the isolated city of Durgoth, where a sadistic killer is prowling the streets and turning its citizens into grotesque works of art. We follow a woman named Maybeth, a once world-renowned artist who has fallen on hard times and now finds herself working alongside the city's peacekeepers, trying to find reason behind the killings and stop the murderer. But is this truly just a case of homicidal madness, just a reflection of the killer's fraying sanity, or is it the harbinger of something far worse, something ancient, malevolent, and darker than Maybeth could possibly imagine? Come with me, my friends. Gather round and listen well as we peel back the layers of madness to find what terrors lurk beneath in the grimdark story hour. But first, a quick shout out to this video's sponsor. If you've been watching my channel for a while, then you know I'm a big fan of Warhammer 40,000 Tacticus, the definitive tactile Warhammer game on mobile. Its matches are fast-paced and brutal, easy to pick up and play, but difficult to master, and it features over 70 iconic champions from Warhammer 40,000 to collect and battle with, spread across 16 playable factions. The big news this month is that the insidious Tyranid-worshipping Genestealer cult is finally being added to the game as a playable faction. These dudes are masters of manipulation and stealth, relying on ambush tactics and hidden rebellions to make them a powerful and unpredictable force. The faction's first champion, Magus Zybia Kaiser, is available in-game right now. And the second, the legendary Genestealer Patriarch, the Patermine, will be available starting on November 3rd, with a special release event that will run through November 9th. If you know me, you know I love summoner archetypes in games like this, and the Genestealer cult is very quickly shaping up to be the masters of summoning. Both the Magus and the Patriarch are able to passively place nodes on the battlefield that reinforcements can pop out of. However, your opponent doesn't know which ones will actually spawn a unit. This keeps them off guard and confused while more and more reinforcements keep coming in to quickly overwhelm them. Tacticus is chock full of content. We're talking multiple full-length faction-specific campaigns, PvP arena battles, guild raids, monthly special events, and so much more. So if you haven't started playing Tacticus yet, now is the perfect time to start. Click on my link in the description of this video and download Warhammer 40,000 Tacticus for free today. Big thanks to Tacticus for sponsoring this video. For all of Maybeth's flaws, of which she would admit there were many, she knew art. Even before the training she had received from the legendary Hakasto as his only protege, art had always been something that was innate to her. It was in her blood, it flowed through every vein and sparked in every synapse. It was a core pillar of who she was as a woman. Her gifts had brought her both fame and fortune, though nowadays, both were in short supply. She had resorted to taking on odd jobs in order to survive, and though her name may not have carried the weight that it once did, there was still work for somebody with her talents in the city of Durgoth, though it was becoming increasingly hard to come by. The job she found herself on tonight, contracted by the city's peacekeepers though, was by far the most disturbing she had ever taken. She found herself in a ruined cathedral on the outskirts of town, bearing witness to the grotesque and the profane, using her skills to render the murder scene in ink and charcoal. Despite the macabre subject matter, she recognized it for what it was. It was art, callous, evil, and some would say blasphemous, but undeniably art nonetheless. The victim was most likely male, though the incisions made by their killer made it difficult to be certain. The body stood erect and cruciform, naked and without modesty. The murder scene almost had a ritualistic quality to it, although the nature of the killer's intended message was lost on both her and the peacekeepers. Maybeth was certain he had meant to make a statement through his work. As she sketched out the body, she couldn't help but reminisce on old times, even if it meant acknowledging just how far she had fallen. In the past, the work her and Acosto had produced together was venerated around the world. She used to have a waiting list of models who would give anything to pose for one of her sketches. Now, the only individuals that would sit for her were the dead, and they had little choice or awareness in the matter. Acosta had been like a father to her, and her life had begun to fall apart the night that he was murdered, stabbed in the chest, likely in an act of jealousy by one of their competitors. Though the killer was never caught, she had wept for 6 days straight, refusing to leave her home or even change out of her mourning dress. Although time had lessened the pain, she had never fully recovered and dwindled away what remained of her fortune on gambling, flights of fancy, expensive luxury clothing, and exotic liquors and narcotics. As she drew, she took in the victim's arms that had been strung up by their own sinews, hanging limply as if some godlike and invisible puppeteer held on to them from above. No, not a puppet, she realized. She had misread the artist's intentions. She sketched splayed feet, their broken toes and bones distended, and the clawed fingers reaching like strange branches. And finally, the position of the body, utterly straight, rigid as any trunk.
A tree,
she murmured aloud, pausing to regard it.
What?
Asked Levio. The proctor was gruff and unshaven, badly dressed and foul of mood, and he hid his irritation poorly.
A tree,
Maybeth repeated, her charcoal stylus poised.
He has been arranged in the manner and aspect of a tree.
There aren't any trees in the city.
I didn't say it was based on anything in Durgoth.
Levio took another look.
I only see some poor bastard tortured to death.
He turned and frowned.
You said arranged.
Maybeth nodded.
Yeah, what do you think it means?
Growth, rebirth, knowledge, maybe?
She said.
A tree has a broad symbolic meaning.
I don't see meaning. I see madness. City's infected with it.
He wasn't wrong. Durgoth had never been a safe place, at least outside of the noble districts. But ever since the sky changed and all of the astropaths died, crime rates had steadily begun to increase. Nobody knew what had happened. One day, everything was normal. And the next, a great rift of crimson split the heavens, and all off-world shipments abruptly ceased. In addition to the lack of visiting ships, without the astropaths, interstellar communication had become impossible. No word in and no word out. The planet had been completely cut off from the rest of the Imperium. With this world's isolation came a sense of powerlessness in the general population. Powerlessness bred fear. Fear bred violence, and so on it went.
Why am I here, Proctor Levio?
Arbitrator wants a record.
He stalled to pick at something in his teeth.
Don't want to come down here to see for herself.
Maybeth gestured to the perturbed-looking hunchback in red robes, busying around a pictor unit.
Then what's he here for? Would a pictograph not capture a more accurate impression of the scene? Not to mention be much faster. I'm not complaining,
she hastened to add.
I need the coin. There's not much work for an artist when every patron has decided to suddenly start hoarding their wealth for the end of days.
I honestly do not know,
admitted Levio.
So far, he's done precisely fuck all.
The hunchback's robes, visible disfigurements, and cybernetic augmentations marked him as a sacristan, an individual wholly dedicated to the utilization and repair of machines. He was switching out parts from the pictor and replacing its power cells, while muttering a series of choice expletives. Levio pulled out a folder from under his coat and handed it to her. She opened it up and flipped through its contents. It was full of dozens of blurred images.
They're all useless,
she said.
Doesn't matter what that hunchback asshole does. Pics won't come out. That's the sixth pictor we've tried.
How long have you been in here?
Levio rubbed his unshaven face, and she had her answer. She turned her attention back to the images. It was as if they had all been overexposed or smeared by a sudden jerk of the lens. But that didn't make any sense. The victim was static, the picture secured, and the light steady.
This is very strange,
she conceded. I've gone from strange to irritating, and I'm circling livid. Or suicidal, said Levio. It changes by the minute. Maybeth glanced down at her sketch. The rendering was good. The curve of the thigh, the overall musculature, the texture of the lank hair and scarred flesh. As vivid as she had ever been on parchment, and almost more real than any pictograph.
I see,
she said, handing back the folder. So if you don't mind, said Levio, hurry the hell up. I can't get out of here until you've finished. He walked away in order to berate the sacristan some more, leaving Maybeth to it.
Charming,
she whispered. She was almost done anyways, just a little bit more detailing left to do. She reached into her field kit and pulled out a magnifying lens that she fit over her left eye. Up close, the scene felt intimate. Every knife stroke revealed, every abuse, and it was neat murder, almost surgical. It spoke to obsession. She let her gaze linger on the victim's face, and she felt as if something was staring back at her through those cold, dead eyes. Perhaps it was recognition. Though she wanted to recoil, she found herself drawn in. The lips were barely parted, but she caught the suggestion of white teeth, and then they moved.
Paradise.
The voice was like a lover's warm breath against her neck, warm and susurrant. The scent of cloying lavender filled her nose. Maybeth tore away the lens, let out a stifled cry, and spun around, but there was no one there. Levio ran back into the room, reaching for his sidearm.
It's nothing,
she said, a little breathless, and out of instinct, touched her neck. It felt cold, like a strange absence. He scowled at her, turned away, and went to light up a smoke. After a few moments, she reluctantly put the lens back on, but when she looked back, nothing had happened. The body remained where it was, just as horrific and lifeless as ever. There was no voice in her ear, no breath on her neck, and no scent of lavender. Just the smell of old blood and musty prayer scrolls, common in an abandoned chapel like this one. She quickly finished her work and handed the drawings to the proctor on the way out.
I expect prompt payment,
she said, as way of a parting shot. She could still hear his coarse laughter, following her all the way until she left the building. Outside, her trusty servitor Gethic was waiting for her as always. His eyes were heavy and dull, barely comprehending his surroundings. As she passed, she commanded the servitor to follow, and he obeyed, clumping clumsily behind her. The night sky was an arterial red, and she could hear shouting in the distance. Gethic may not have been a combat servitor and made for a truly miserable bodyguard, but he was big and intimidating, and the city was dangerous. It paid to have protection. She always hated the way he smelled, like machine oil, rust, and ammonia, but right now, she found herself enjoying it, as it helped banish the memory of that sickly lavender. She made her way to the magrail and found a seat in one of the train cars. When the other patrons saw her servitor, they gave her a wide berth. As the train made its rattling journey through the city, she looked out of the grimy window and tried to remember everything as she had experienced it in the church. The voice, the breath, the lavender. Surely it had just been a hallucination, brought on by stress, but it felt so real. The voice had been so peculiar, she didn't know how her mind would be capable of forming it. It was definitely male for sure, but both old and melodic, with an accent she couldn't trace. Definitely not one she had ever heard on Durgoth. She found her fingers gently rubbing at the back of her neck as everything in her world began to grow hazy. And then she heard it again.
Paradise.
She sat bolt upright, suddenly aware of her surroundings. She was sweating and her heart was racing, but when she looked into the reflection of the glass, the only face staring back at her was her own. She saw her clothing and her jewelry, good robes and a vermilion cloak. It may have been last season's fashion, and she knew she wouldn't be able to keep it up like she used to. But even still, her attire was nicer than what most people here could afford. It spoke of affluence, of success. She smiled and took a moment to admire her reflection. But just behind the grimming image of her own face was another. It was human, but big, with a rictus smile that spread unnaturally wide. She turned around, her heart pounding in her chest, but there was no one sitting behind her. A few of the factorum workers farther in the back of the carriage glanced in her direction, surprised by the sudden movement, but quickly lost interest. She looked back at her reflection, but the face was gone. She had been so startled that she nearly missed her stop and had to dash for the exit, Gethic lumbering in tow.
"I need to find a different line of work, Gethic,"
she said, rubbing her eyes as they walked. He didn't reply. He never did, merely shadowed her as always. After a short walk from the train, they approached the old Auric house, the hab unit that had served as her home for many years and whose history mirrored her own. Way back in the day, the Auric house had been a world-renowned place of grandeur and luxury, an exclusive gathering place for lucrative artistic types. Now it was decaying, its glitz and glamour replaced with cracking paint and tarnished walls. She greeted the door warden with a tired wave and headed inside. But as she passed him, just out of the corner of her eye, she could have sworn she saw him grinning back at her under the vision slit of his helmet, his smile too large, his teeth too white. She recoiled, but the guard's sour look reappeared almost immediately.
"I'm losing my damn mind,"
she said as she hurried up the stairs to her apartment. Everything was as she had left it. The hookah pipe, her silks and fine drapery, the ornaments and artist lectern, as well as the many empty bottles of Amasek and absinthe. She lit the lamps and collapsed on a pile of plush cushions, her hand outstretched for a drink that Gethic instinctively provided. She told them to leave her to her drinking and then reached out to light up the hookah. She took several long drafts of the Kalma smoke. It was expensive and not easy to get a hold of, but to her, it was worth every penny. She drank and smoked until she felt her eyelids growing heavy, fingers slipping from the neck of the pipe. She drifted off into a fitful sleep, her last conscious thoughts being of the sickly sweet scent of lavender. She dreamed of a forest, but not one made from trees. It was a forest of the dead, each body standing unnaturally stiff, their feet rooted to the earth and their limbs contorting into twisting elongated branches, each oozing the thick red sap of their blood. She awoke drenched in a sweat, the lingering scent of warm copper already fading from her memory. Her room was filled with the gray light of early morning. Gethic was standing over her.
"What in the hells?"
she croaked, annoyed at her own skittishness. Her throat was dry and scratchy, and her voice came out as a choked rasp. It was as if she had been screaming in her sleep, but she couldn't remember why or what she had dreamt about. Whatever the subject of her nightmares, she reasoned her thrashing must have triggered Gethic's protection protocols. She told the servitor that she was fine and was about to wave him off when she noticed that he had something clutched in his right hand. It was a long cylindrical package with an attached note. It was from Urena, an ex-lover turned abettor, as the trajectory of Maybeth's career changed and so did her suitors. For the most part, they had stayed on friendly terms, and now their relationship was purely business. Even still, seeing her delicate handwriting again triggered old memories and provoked a frisson of lust. Whereas Maybeth had grown more reclusive ever since Acasto's death, Urena still diligently maintained a vast and somewhat secretive web of connections and clientele. She would act as a middleman between Maybeth and clients in need of a skilled artist. It had actually been Urena who secured Maybeth's contract with the Peacekeepers in the first place. Definitely not Maybeth's preferred work, but it kept her glasses full and the debtors away, so she was grateful to her nonetheless. She took the package from Gethic, laid it on the table, and unfurled the note. "Mab," it began, "I think I may have found the last decent paying commission in this entire shit heap of a city. A private contract, 3 pieces, simple restoration needed. Yes, I know it's still low-end, but it pays better than the Peacekeepers, and there are fewer dead bodies. P.S. That ugly golem of yours needs a wash." The package itself clearly originated from a mercantile house. It was marked with the letter V and the commissioner's address.
"Well done, Urena."
Inside of the tube, she found an envelope containing half of the fee paid up front and 3 rolled pieces of canvas. She unfurled them and laid them out on the floor. Each was a painting depicting a holy scene from the Imperium's history. They were all faded and in clear need of restoration. She didn't recognize any of the saints, cardinals, or other spiritual leaders depicted. She only saw the work that needed to be done. She fashioned some simple frames for them, mounted them, and set them on her lectern. She studied them and regarded it as a set, even though the styles differed enough to indicate that they were painted by different artists at different points in time. She wondered what interest a mercantile house would have with ecclesiarchical relics like these. Before she could get to work, she had to determine their condition and assess any and all damage. The canvases were old and clearly had not been disturbed in quite some time. Each of the paintings had been preserved with oils, which caused them to stiffen and flake at the edges. She worked steadily, reinvigorating the tired pastels, giving them vibrance and depth. The brighter she made the images, the lighter her mood became. The work was methodical and repetitive, but she found it strangely soothing. It was as if faith and protection radiated from these canvases and balmed the fear and uneasiness from before. She got so lost in her work that the hours passed by without her realizing. She was in the middle of restoring a cardinal's vestments when suddenly her phonogram began to ring, causing her to jump in alarm. She turned and picked it up and heard Levio on the other end.
Need your talents again.
I have other work, Proctor.
That can wait. Your contract gives the city unrestricted access.
Can it possibly wait? I am in the middle of something.
So am I. It's another one.
Same as last time?
Different.
Different how?
I'm not describing it over the phonogram. He snapped, then quickly regained his composure. Just get down here.
He cut the feed, and the phonogram line went dead. Maybeth looked back at the paintings. They would have to wait, for the dead, it seemed, would not. Just like before, the second murder also took place in a dilapidated church. As she entered the sanctuary, she had to crane her neck to see the victim, who had been suspended in the air on a series of wires. But as she looked, to her horror, she realized that they weren't wires at all. They were veins. Veins that had been pulled from its arms and woven together like wire. The killer had hung the dead like a piece of fine art to be admired. Behind the victim was an immense window, its glass smeared in blood. Dim red light streamed through, casting the chamber in arterial red, the body creating a ragged dark shadow. Its arms were outstretched and its legs pinned together. But most disturbingly of all, the victim's skin had been flayed from its back and chest and then spread out behind it like a pair of leathery wings in a horrific mockery of an angel. Its ribs were splayed open and rimmed with glistening blood. A rubbery track unfurled from its abdomen like a gory streamer into a pile of intertwined organs that had been heaped below it. Mysteriously, the killer had left the victim's face unmarred, with one exception. One of the eyes had been carved out.
Throne,
uttered Maybeth and swiftly covered her mouth. She could smell Levio walking up to stand beside her. He reeked of sweat and cheap tobacco.
I understand why you didn't want to describe it over phonogram.
An Aquila,
he replied, gesturing at the victim's altered form.
Even I can discern that much. Who the hell does that?
I don't know, a religious fanatic? Aren't you supposed to work that out?
Levio rubbed his scalp. He looked paler and older since last night.
I've no frame of reference for this.
It would take strength,
ventured Maybeth.
And precision.
Still think it's art?
I think the killer does.
Levio lit up a smoke.
Paradise.
Maybeth turned on him.
What did you just say?
Going off of his expression, she must have looked horrified. He held up his hands.
That's just what the witness said.
What bloody witness?
She was livid, practically shaking. The smile, the sickly scent of lavender.
Easy, said Levio. Calm down.
Maybeth stared at him, her heart pounding. She felt feverish. A cold sweat clung to her body like a rotten bandage.
Are you all right?
She snapped back, hard as a spring. The fever ebbed.
I'm fine,
she lied.
I didn't know there had been a witness.
Why does it matter?
Someone is killing people seemingly at random and turning them into grotesque anatomical works of art.
Maybeth replied, still a little shaky.
I am both professionally intrigued and personally appalled. Of course it matters. Who is the witness?
An old curate. The church was mostly in a state of disrepair. He was effectively the caretaker until it could be restored. Though not much chance of that, given the state of things. He's back at the precinct house with the interrogators, who are trying to find out what he knows.
He didn't tell them?
Beyond saying that word, he hadn't said much of anything. Whatever he saw, he didn't like it. And it definitely wasn't him who did it before you ask.
At this point, she had had just about enough of the proctor, but she gathered up her tools and got to work. The sooner she was finished with her sketching, the sooner she could leave. After it was all said and done, and she had taken her leave of the crime scene, she was forced to take a longer route to the maglev than normal. The violence had gotten worse this night, and she knew it was unwise to take chances, even with Gethick by her side. It was dark by the time she made it home, and the memory of the flayed angel as she had come to regard the second victim still lingered in her mind like a bad odor. No matter how hard she tried to block it out, it wouldn't go away. Even a long shower and the safety of her apartment did little to ease her discomfort. She poured herself a glass of absinthe to calm her fractious nerves. On the way back, she had avoided looking into any reflective surfaces, glass or otherwise, and set to work covering every mirror in her home with a blanket. Whether because of her efforts or because she had simply been losing her mind before, there were no more visitations from the Lavender Man. Even still, she didn't want to be alone. She thought about calling Urena, but didn't want to leave her hab, what with the violence and the curfew. And it's not like she could have anybody over. She didn't want anyone seeing how she was living. The apartment was a mess and covered in empty liquor bottles. Instead, she poured herself another glass and turned to the paintings on her lectern. It wasn't like she was going to be able to sleep anyways, and the work offered at least some semblance of refuge via spiritual tonic. Maybeth threw herself into her work, the craft taking on an almost obsessive-compulsive quality that caused the hours to fly by. Every small act of restoration felt like it was cleansing part of her soul and lessened the lingering imagery in her mind and the imagined scent of lavender. She was peeling back layers of ink and pigment from the most degraded areas of the canvas in order to build them back up anew, when she suddenly noticed something unexpected that caused her to stop. She scraped away the oldest particles of paint and noticed a small part of a second image underneath the first. Puzzled, she grabbed a magnifying lens and brought it into sharper focus. She couldn't tell what the second image was depicting, but it clearly wasn't part of any religious scene. It was a pentimento, as her master used to call it, a layer beneath a layer. It's what happened when, for one reason or another, an artist would have a change of heart mid-painting. They'd cover up the old image entirely and paint something new. Sometimes bits of the old image would be incorporated into the new one, and other times it was concealed entirely. From what little of the hidden image had been revealed, there wasn't enough to discern anything of particular note about its subject matter. But she found the rationale for hiding it intriguing nonetheless.
Curious,
Maybeth muttered. She began to scrape away at the old pigment, more than she initially intended to, but reasoned that she could easily repair it later. This thing beneath, this secret, beguiled her. At this point, it was the deep night hours, and the heavy dose of stem she had taken to keep her going was starting to wear off. Eventually, the scalpel slipped from her grasp, and she fell into an exhausted sleep at her lectern. She woke sometime later to a feeling of disquiet and the vague memory of a troubling dream that, try as she might to grasp, dissipated like smoke. Sensations remained, of pain and pleasure, the instinct of peeling back the layers of her skin to reveal the dark places within. She shivered, despite the warmth of the morning and the blanket she had wrapped herself in. She rubbed her eyes and looked up at the canvases, but to her complete shock, far more of the second image had been revealed than she remembered. She had no recollection of working on the other two yet, but it was the same across all three. Each had the same signs of a similar hidden image that had been partially revealed. Blacking out and losing track of time and events was never something she enjoyed for obvious reasons, but it wasn't unheard of when one mixed together a cocktail of alcohol and stimulants. Needless to say, it wasn't unfamiliar territory for her.
Gethick,
she slurred, still drowsy. The servitor lumbered from its alcove.
Show me the vid from last night.
Gethick stumbled over to a cogitator sitting on a low table, plugged it into a socket on his side, and opened his mouth, revealing a flickering projector bulb that cast a vid feed onto an adjacent wall. Like many artists of her time, she had set up a series of vid feeds around her abode in order to capture her artistic process for later review.
Here we go,
she whispered as the vid capture began to render and cycle. But then she frowned and glared over her shoulder at Gethick.
I said last night.
Confirmed,
he said in a mechanized rasp.
This is everything?
Confirmed.
Her eyes narrowed, disbelieving.
Are you certain, Gethic?
Confirmed.
Something must have gone wrong. Her vid unit was clearly faulty, as the images cascading across her wall were blurred and overexposed, just like the ones Levio had shown her the other night. Only this time, they were in motion. She squinted, straining her eyes and focusing intently on the vid feed in order to see past the image flicker.
What in the hells?
Even blurry and overexposed, the vid didn't look like anything in her apartment. The colors were wrong, and every now and then, she caught a glimpse of something solid. Something that looked like bones. There was a sudden hard knock at the door that caused her heart to nearly jump right out of her throat. She cursed loudly and stumbled over to the apartment entryway, putting her ear up against the door.
Identify.
They couldn't reach it via phonogram.
Levio grumbled through the door.
So you came into my abode?
Maybeth snapped. Although muffled, she could hear him muttering something unseemly about artists and their ilk.
So can I come in, or do we shout at each other through your door?
She was tempted, but she gestured to Gethic to cut the pict feed, the wall returning to its blank state, and she let Levio in. The sight of the proctor, disheveled, pale, and even thin, brought back the fear he had become synonymous with.
Is it him?
She asked in a quiet voice.
The Lavender Man?
Levio nodded and didn't challenge her. He had smelled it too, which meant that she hadn't imagined it. There was something else going on.
Take me there,
she said, sparing a weary glance back at the paintings. Everything about the next murder was different. It wasn't in a church or a temple. There was no blood-stained glass or dusty prayer scrolls. Instead, it had been done in a park, a large clearing surrounded by woodlands. The body had been staked out, its limbs meticulously and perfectly bifurcated, four becoming eight and arranged in the shape of an eight-pointed star. It had been meticulously drained of every last drop of blood, causing the victim's pale flesh to shimmer in the rain like wet marble. The peacekeepers wore black carapace and were armed this time, each carrying a shotgun to ward off curious spectators.
Why?
She asked simply.
Why what? Levio answered. I'm not a damn mind shriver. How should I know why the sick bastard is doing this?
No,
said Maybeth patiently.
Why do you need me to illustrate this?
It has to be captured, known, he said, then added more quietly. Allegedly, certain parties are interested.
He extended his middle finger so that it looked like the letter I.
Interrogators?
And worse, I expect.
He lit a smoke, and Maybeth noticed that his fingers were trembling.
Look, if you don't want to, I can say I couldn't find you.
Won't your colleagues say I was here?
Maybeth gestured to the peacekeepers on sentry duty in the distance, partially veiled by the rain. She pulled up her coat collar, but it wasn't much comfort.
They want rid of this as much as I do. City's going to the hells in case you didn't notice.
She'd noticed.
So, they don't give two shits about you.
Reassuring.
You know what I mean.
Maybeth stared on at the body. It was so cold. So beautiful. It was immaculate in every way. The work of a true artist.
I want to do it,
she said, mumbling the words. The weather had grown steadily worse since she had arrived, and Levio sheltered her with the parasol she had brought to the scene, his face a picture of resigned annoyance.
Is it a statement? Is that it?
He asked after a while.
Is that what he's doing, do you think?
Maybeth kept illustrating, her strokes deft and assured, despite the horrific nature of her composition.
I don't think it's as random as it appears,
said Maybeth.
A tree, an angel, and now this.
She paused to flex her fingers, which were tight after prolonged use of a charcoal stylus.
It's almost as if he's recreating something. A ritual, perhaps.
The parasol shivered as Levio tried to stifle a sudden intake of breath.
Ever since the skies changed, he said at length, the city's changed, and us with it.
By us, he meant Durgoff citizens.
It's always been bad here. Murder, discord, the things people will do to each other. I've seen it all. But this is the first time I've ever felt such fear. Not just my own, but it's everywhere. It's like it slipped in through the cracks when the sky turned red, and it's been seeping into us ever since. It's in our air, our food, our bodies.
What are you trying to say, Proctor?
He rubbed his chin, the lip biting now chronic.
Have you ever felt rain before it starts? You know, smelled it or tasted it on the air and just knew?
Of course. Hasn't everyone to some extent?
It feels like that. Like something's coming. only it isn't rain. He fell silent after that. She finished up her work and gave him a curt wave as she turned to take her leave. He had a vacant look in his eyes and seemed almost hollow. He reminded her of Gethic. Something is coming, only it isn't rain. The words followed her after she left the murder scene, and so too the scent of lavender, faint on the air. Levio must have smelled it too, but neither spoke of it. To do so would only make it more real. She returned to her home, ready to indulge in the pious restoration of the saints, purification through art. She had only been working for a few minutes when the brush suddenly paused in her hand.
"I have to know,"
she murmured as a deep obsession took hold. She was as the proverbial sailor and the Pentimento her siren. She would go gratefully to their rocks. She put down the brush, picked up a scalpel, and turned her attention to the promise of the unknown. She worked feverishly, almost in a frenzy, scraping away flecks of paint like skin from a flayed corpse. The pigment peeled away without resistance, as if what was lurking beneath wanted to be found, as if it had been waiting for this for a very long time. After several hours of peeling and scraping, a vista began to materialize beneath the veneer of the first. It was Eden, a beautiful landscape of lush, exotic flowers and strange crystals that twinkled in the sunlight. But there was something else here, something that her own eyes refused to acknowledge. Even still, comprehension struck her like a mag train, and she realized her mistake, her awful, terrible mistake. This landscape, it was
paradise.
She rasped and fell into a deep, fathomless dream. She is walking barefoot, the morning dew cool and refreshing against her bare skin. A grove has risen up around her, swollen with strange trees, ripe with luscious, heart-shaped fruit. She's tempted to reach out and pluck one, but something stops her. She can hear thunder in the distance, or what sounds like thunder, and a white noise susurration, a murmur at first that steadily grows in droning intensity. She freezes like prey that's caught the scent of a predator. She turns, and she sees him. His image obscured in shadow, cast by the strange trees. He is nude, apart from a modest cloth around his waist. He is beautiful, tall, a study in anatomical perfection, like the statue of a demigod given perfect animation. He is strong, his muscles carved as if from pink opal, framed by a cascading mane of silver hair that drapes his shoulders, his violet eyes glinting and flashing to life as he approaches. Amused, desirous, she flushes, terror and arousal, warring like belligerent nations. In an instant of connection, she knows him, or rather what he represents. He was the paragon of pleasures, a lord of excess who had come for her.
"I know you,"
he says, though his lips are unmoving.
"I am you."
And for a brief moment, she knows nothing but profound bliss. Until the blades unsheath and the hooks unfurl. She feels herself pinioned and torn apart. She is undressed of skin. It flutters away in the wind like thin parchment. He smiles, that overwide, unnatural smile, his teeth like pearls, the scent of lavender overwhelming. She doesn't scream. She can barely breathe. She feels something heavy pressing against her chest. She thrashes, and a lamp shatters as she kicks it. A decanter of liquor spills, and the drapes tear beneath her grasping fingers as the sunlight crashes in. There, in an instant, there was relief, the pain vanishing as Maybeth stared on, blinking, in the revelations brought by morning light. The paintings were no longer three, but one. A triptych of paradise, of vigorous, staggering gardens unmatched in beauty spread across three canvases. She stared on, her mouth agape. It was like a foreign country to her senses. The garden was seeded with bones and nourished by blood. It was Eden birthed by slaughter. Her eyes were drawn to the center, where a familiar grove stood out, its strange trees burgeoning with heart-shaped fruit. But they weren't fruit. They were hearts, living, beating human hearts, and they were no trees, but people, the dead, rooted and cruciform. Her blood turned to ice, and she recoiled, shuffling away on her backside, kicking madly until she backed into a wall and could flee no further. Her gaze was transfixed, unblinking on the paintings. Her work remained incomplete. There were still parts of the original images left to be removed, more horrors yet to be revealed. Maybeth sat there, trembling and unmoving, unable to speak or even sleep for 3 days straight, her trance only broken when Levio contacted her again.
Fires had broken out across the city, and the air was full of the baying, hooting sounds of desperate men. The thick, acrid clouds of smoke did little to hide the blood-red sky that had only turned deeper and more crimson with the onset of night. After exiting the maglev, she did her best to avoid the crowds, choosing to take forgotten side streets instead of the main ones, Gethic following close behind her. The rioting scared her, of course, but that fear had been dulled by something far darker, something she couldn't ignore that continued to call out to her. Levio was waiting with two armored peacekeepers, both wielding shotguns. He looked skeletal thin, with deep rings sunk in his eyes. He finished a low stick and crushed it beneath his heel, where it joined a pile of others. He lit another and gestured over his shoulder at a nearby mausoleum. Inside, Maybeth followed, leaving Gethic and the two sentries outside. The fourth location was a tomb, one she assumed was constructed for some dignitary of the city, most likely of the ecclesiarchy, based on the prevalent religious symbolism throughout. To her right, she saw what appeared to be a pile of neatly folded robes in the corner, and in front of her stood a reliquary upon a plinth in the middle of the gloomy chamber. Above the plinth was the killer's latest creation. Although this time, there didn't seem to be any victim. Instead, the bones of two saints had been removed from their sarcophagi and entwined, their heads upturned to a light that they would never see, their bony hands outstretched as if in mocking supplication.
I don't understand. Where is the...
Levio ignited his lumen, and the bones shone faint pink. She gasped as the awful truth revealed itself.
Emperor.
He isn't here,
breathed Levio. They weren't robes in the corner of the room after all, and the bones had not been stolen from any crypt.
How?
Levio didn't answer, and that was answer enough. She approached the reliquary to get a better look. The bones had strange markings scrimshawed into them that she didn't recognize, and outside, she could hear the clamor of the riots growing louder and coming closer. Over and over, she saw the same word carved into femurs, rib bones, and clavicles. Paradisium. It was High Gothic, a dialect rarely used nowadays, but supposedly more common a long time ago. She heard the sound of gunfire, a warning shot from one of the peacekeepers at the crowds outside. The gathering mob responded, a coalition of voices answering as one. Paradise, they shouted.
I can't do this,
she said as she dropped her tools and fled the chamber. She stepped outside into chaos. The crowd was frenzied, like fearful wild animals fleeing from fire and knives, desperate to quench their terror with blood. The shotgun barked again, so close it made her jump and her ears ring with tinnitus. The tomb was situated in a natural valley, and in the distance, coming down the ramps, she could see more men being drawn in. The shotgun barked again, this time no longer in warning, as a man was cut down. The peacekeepers bellowed their authority at the coming horde, but their words lacked conviction. Levio didn't join them, choosing instead to stay behind with the dead. Breathless, terrified, her mind close to shutting down, Maybeth called out.
Gethic!
She rasped.
Get me away from here!
The servitor obeyed, his lurching patchwork frame never more reassuring as it drove like a plow into the mob. She stayed close behind him, desperately clinging to his belt. Behind her, she could hear the shotgun speak again and again until it had run out of words, and a press of shouting men descended upon them. Luckily, the mob seemed to have no interest in her, though she surely would have been collateral if it had not been for Gethic, who was now acting like a battering ram. She tried not to think about it, but she knew that he had killed a few in his charge. She could hear bones breaking underneath and cries of pain suddenly choked off under his lumbering iron footfalls. After pushing their way through the last of the riot, the servitor began to slow down. He stumbled, a dozen wounds spilling blood and oil, his dull eyes as uncomprehending as always. A servitor is a cyborg, but it's still a thing of flesh, and she knew his injuries were mortal. He kept going as far as he could, committed to protecting her all the way up until the end. Eventually, he slumped in a manner akin to a puppet going slack after its strings had been cut. Half blind in panic, she left him behind and ran the rest of the way to her hab building. She bolted up the stairs, got to her unit, and threw herself inside. Her heart was hammering in her chest as she made her way into the studio where the paintings stood. But they had changed. More of the old renderings of the saints had been further scraped away. Whether by her hand or another, She could no longer tell. She went to the phonogram and tried to contact Yurena. She had an entire speech prepared. She would demand to know where these paintings came from and who the sick bastard was that commissioned her services. She would refuse the rest of the payment, claim the paintings were occult, and would threaten to report them to the interrogators. But Yurena never answered. The phonogram returned only cold, dead static. She slammed the receiver cup down so hard it shattered part of the plastic. She wanted to scream. She wanted to harness all of her anger as a natural antidote to her fear. Above all else, she wanted answers and to be rid of the paintings for good. Against her better senses, she snatched up all three of them, quickly bundled them together, and made her way back out into the city. Part of her wanted to simply burn them and be done with it, but she knew it would only make things worse for her. After everything that had happened, everything she had been through, adding a powerful and angry patron to her woes was not something she desired. After all, the merchants of Durgoff were known for many things, but forgiveness, especially in matters of property, was not one of them. It might not matter anyways, the city was burning, at least here in the slums and the poorer districts, something that would surely spread to the merchant and noble districts in good time. A fever of madness had gripped the population, and their fear had spread like a plague. She knew all too well that terror was a great motivator for selfish men to hide their anxieties behind cruelty and violence. She wanted to turn back. She wanted to shut herself away. She wanted to barricade herself inside her home and never come back out. But she knew she couldn't. She had to see this through. She had to make sure that these were returned to their rightful owner. Only then could she go back into that familiar comfort of hiding. She had been hiding for a long time, ever since Acosto. Ever since. She was so lost in her thoughts, she almost didn't realize that she had arrived at her destination. Valgast Exports. She had never heard of it, but the address matched what was on the original package. The property was made up of both a nondiscreet warehouse and connecting office building, surrounded by a tall fence of razor wire. The entire thing was on fire. Every square inch was wreathed in flames that reached into the sky and stained the foreboding crimson vista black with smoke. For how intensely the fire raged, impossibly, its flames had somehow not spread to any of the surrounding buildings. It was only this property that burned, and there was no sign of arson. The mob had yet to reach this district. It didn't make any sense, and the oddness of the fire caused her grip to tighten around the canvases. She wanted to tear them apart, rend them into pieces, and cast the remains into the flames, but she didn't. Instead, she sank to her knees and began to weep. After a few minutes, she took a deep, trembling breath and regained her composure. She couldn't stay here. The streets were dangerous, and she no longer had Gethic to protect her. She needed to get back to her building. She got up and stumbled through the side streets, but it wasn't long before the mob found her. It was a group of men in grubby overalls, menial workers, that eyed her hungrily. The fine clothing and jewelry that she had once took such pride in did exactly as it was meant to. It marked her as the other, someone above the dregs she was surrounded by. To them, she appeared as a wealthy noblewoman who had taken a wrong turn down a dangerous street unprotected. They started in her direction, and she backed away slowly. She looked around for an escape, and her eyes fell upon an alleyway she somehow hadn't noticed before. She took it, running like a startled cat. She could hear them pick up pace behind her, and she threw the canvases over her shoulder at them. She didn't care anymore about the merchants. They could burn with the warehouse for all she cared. Behind her, she could hear grunting and the sound of heavy, dirty boots. They were closing in, driven on by something animalistic. As she ran, she could hear them getting closer and closer, and then suddenly, there was nothing. After a few hundred yards, she slowed to a stop. The faint scent of lavender prickled her nose, and she whirled around in panic, half expecting to see him. But the alley she was in was empty. No one was chasing her either. The entire street was silent, as if holding its breath. It had been a close call, and she wasn't going to take her good fortune for granted. She stayed out of sight and made her way back to the old Auric house. She staggered inside, her breathing coming in ragged gasps. She was shaking uncontrollably, and as the adrenaline began to bleed away, the trauma settled in. A drink would ease her nerves, and maybe a whole bottle, maybe two. The edge of her glass chinked as it met the lip of the bottle. She filled it, drained it down in a single gulp, poured another, and then drained that too. She started to calm down and took the bottle and glass with her as she went to find a nice place to slump. As she passed the open archway of the studio, the bottle and glass slipped from her fingers, shattering against the floor. It was impossible. It couldn't be. She was frozen with fear, her body momentarily locked in place. She had to strain to turn her neck and look into her own studio. There, on the lectern, were all three canvases, the last of the paint beginning to fragment and flake away like dead skin. She found herself being drawn to them, to it. Without conscious thought, she entered the studio, picked up her scalpel, and began to scrape away at the upper layer. With every stroke, greater and greater horrors revealed themselves. It was a scene of beauty and torture, of unparalleled human suffering, so vivid she swore she could hear the screaming. Tears were streaming down her face, but she couldn't pull away. It had her now. Perhaps it had taken her long ago on that first night. Perhaps this was inevitable. Hakusto had always taught her that art was a voyeur upon the soul, its flaws and virtues laid bare upon canvas. This painting, this true image, was a conduit to the realm of the soul, and something had found its way through. In the center of the painting, the Lavender Man stood proudly amongst his depravity, his paradise, immortalized in oil paint. Whoever the artist had been had captured his essence perfectly. Her hand froze as a terrible thought entered her mind. She wondered if any of this was actually paint. She felt a gentle touch on the back of her hand, nudging her to continue. She shuddered as the scent of lavender, stronger than ever now, filled her nose, and she felt a warm breath on the back of her neck.
"I am here,"
the killer said without speaking.
"As I promised I would be."
She had done this. Her pride, her obsession, her excesses, it had brought her to his attention.
"Please."
She tried to whisper, but a soft susurration stayed any further objection. The city outside was eating itself. The rioting was everywhere. It had risen like a black tide to wash away anything good and pure. She bit her lips so hard it drew blood, desperately trying to use pain to drown out her fear. The cloying scent of the Lavender Man's perfume made her gag, but she couldn't stop. She could feel the heat of his skin near her own, both a furnace and a glacier. She scraped away the above to reveal the below, knowing that as she did, his foothold in reality solidified. A dead sky presented itself, blood red and terrible. A great wall thronged with desperate fighting in the distance, gods and monsters vying for the fate of mankind. The thoughts came unbidden, the memories and realizations not her own.
"Terra!"
A voice in her head told her. She knew it then. The vista revealed upon the canvas, an ancient war, the oldest of wars, the Great Heresy.
"The Long War,"
the voice supplied, and could not hold back its bitterness. The last piece began to fall away, a nondiscreet corner, but its style at odds with the rest, as if it was painted by a different hand. Two robed figures, one laying prone and bleeding, and the other towering over them. She gasped in disbelief and sheer terror. It was her, a perfect portrait of herself on the night she murdered Hakusto. In her hand was clutched a red-stained blade, and the dying man on the ground feebly clutched at the wound in his chest, blood pouring from his mouth. A look of shock, horror, and betrayal rendered in oil upon his face as clearly as any picked. It was an impossible image, a rendering of her crime as damning as any confession.
"Perfection always comes at a price,"
she heard the Lavender Man say, his perfumed breath breaking her dark remembrance. The hand on her neck was firm, but not painful. Not yet. It tugged, turning her head. As she turned, she saw her living conditions as if for the first time. The indulgence, the trappings of wealth, of vanity, of desire and obsession.
"Tell me, what did your master call it? That which is hidden beneath?"
"Pentimento,"
said Maybeth, almost beyond the ability for rational thought.
"It means redemption,"
she added, a needless translation, her gaze now fixed upon the image of her murdering Hakusto, so she could be preeminent, so she could be perfect.
"A lie to hide another lie,"
the killer answered, his organic voice as old as millennia. Maybeth would find no redemption here, she realized. As the blades and the hooks bit into her flesh, she screamed as they started to pull.
But there will always be art,
the killer replied, as if reading her thoughts.
And this, my canvas.